Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, and I'm net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m. we do this, and so it's Sunday night, it's 8 p.m. So welcome to the Hanukkah edition of the Limark Technical Net tonight. I hope everyone enjoys the festivities one way or the other. Let me drop for a second, and I'll give you the usual links. Okay, well, as per usual, if anyone can't reach me via the radio here on the repeater, email is a good substitute. That would be either for mailbag questions or topics that they would either like to hear discussed or share in the discussion or offer the discussion. Also, if you have any technological puzzles that you'd like to share with me, they're very difficult to find, but when I do, I really enjoy going over them with the audience, and hopefully we could all either learn or relearn stuff that we forgot. Also, if you have something that you want to ask Paul, you can either use this email address, again, which is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, I'll repeat, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Or you can get to him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. In addition, have some interesting articles on a link page. Last week, we had a very interesting discussion about how electrical energy is not sent through wires, as we were taught, but actually, like the electrical engineers tend to know, travels on the dielectric in the form of electromagnetic waves. So there were a lot of YouTubers out there that jumped on that topic this past week to make a little ad revenue. Some of them were okay. Some of them were really, really weird. And if you want to, we can sort of discuss that as well later on tonight. The link page is roy.ac2gs.com. We have a chat room. You can either go to Limark's own website, find the link, click it, and get to the chat room, or you could just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that will bring you there. As always, I like to stream the technical net, and I keep the stream going 24/7. So if you have internet access but not radio access, you can listen to the W2VL Glen Oaks repeater by just typing into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, I like to remind people of Mike KC2NJI's wonderful archive of all the technical nets going as far back as September of 2006. His site is amateurradio.tv. He's already gotten more than a million visitors, so go there or take a look at it when you have a chance. It's full of wisdom of hams that some of them are still around, fortunately, but some have become silent keys. Let me drop for a moment, and I'll tell you my plans for tonight. Okay, as per usual, I will ask for any questions of a technical nature. I will take first names and call signs. We will try to get to them in an orderly fashion. I would like to keep the first set of questions focused on amateur radio technology, because we are amateur radio operators and this is a repeater. After we get through the amateur radio material, if you want to generalize the questions to any aspect of science or medicine, we do not diagnose nor treat on the radio, but if there are some questions out there, and I assume one or two people might have some questions about the new Omicron variant, it'll be an opportunity to ask the questions and discuss the topics. That should take us to approximately 10:15, we will call upon Paul, WS2N, to give us the SpaceNet report. That will take us to about 11 p.m., and I'll return and tie a bow on it and wish you a safe and happy week. So that's my plan. If all the electronics agrees with me and the radio works and all the little components that make it work continue to work. So that's the idea. If anyone out there has any questions of a technical nature, especially amateur radio related, please give me your first name and your call sign.
Lou, NY2H.
WS2N, Paul, with a yes.
Lou recognized, Paul recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, perhaps later on there'll be more people with questions or comments. Lou, NY2H, what's your question or your comment for tonight?
Well, good evening, Roy. My recent Sunday nights have been very busy. I've had social commitments, so I've been missing the net. So last night I played last week's net on Mike's website and listened to that, and I'm glad you addressed the field aspect to current in a conductor, because I had seen that on the web, and then I went to your site, and I saw that you did address it, so that was very cool. Since no one stepped up with an amateur question, and maybe this is more scientific than amateur, maybe you'll entertain it now. My question is, superconductivity, you know, induced in the cryogenic atmosphere, how does that relate to this whole field theory of transfer of energy from a source to a load through a conductor? What's actually going on with superconductivity in cryogenics? I thought that was, you know, had to do with the electrons. Of course, I was confused like a lot of people. And now I'm appreciating it's a field theory phenomenon. So how do you tie that into cryogenic effect?
Okay, that's going to be complicated. The understanding of superconductivity is probably not complete. At one point, people thought that they had a good sense of what was going on at the very low temperatures. And then, unfortunately, they found a new group of compounds that behaved in a superconducting fashion at somewhat higher temperatures. And so we now have type 1 and type 2 superconductors to deal with. Apparently, the best theories that I have read on the subject have something to do with electrons becoming what are called, I just blanked on the damn term for the darn thing. Cooper pairs, yes. There is a very strange quantum state in which local electrons seem to couple with no resistance whatsoever, and so the electron charge, it flows through superconductors via coupled Cooper pair of electrons. So superconductors is not, as far as I understand, an electromagnetic quality. It is a quantum effect of electron interactions. The movement of electrical charge in the wires still manifests the same electromagnetic wave phenomena, and produce the same waves with the absence of a resistive loss in the circuit. So superconductors, as best I understand them, are quantum mechanical aspects of electron coupling, not electromagnetism as such.
Yeah. It is a duality, right? Because we're going back to the electrons rather than the fields. So that's a little weird. The other things I heard you mention, you know, this goes from DC all the way up, that if you had a high enough frequency, the electrons would hardly move in the conductor. So I assume that it's, you know, I don't know if it's the motion of the electron which is inducing the field. In any event, I guess if it wasn't a field theory, transformers would never work.
Well, yeah, I mean, transformers are really fundamentally field theory devices because they're not connected to each other by conductors. They're interacting on an electromagnetic field. Now, the thing that has always troubled me, and I've discussed this with Dick and I've discussed it with a few of the electrical engineers who listen to these technical nets, is the electromagnetism in a transformer is sometimes called a transformer field. Sometimes we call it the near field. Transformer field and reactive field and near field tends to have a very strange characteristic. It is orthogonal to the electric field and the magnetic field are orthogonal. So when you see the lovely picture of electromagnetism going through space and the electric field is in phase with the magnetic field, that's a far field phenomena. In the near field, it's not that way. And I have tried repeatedly to get someone to explain to me the transition from the near field or reactive field or transformer field to the far field of how does an electromagnetic wave that's orthogonal at the beginning end up to be temporally in phase. And everyone that's tried to explain it to me kind of fudged the answer. So I get the feeling that we still don't know that. But, yeah, it's quite correct. Transformers are a wonderful example of this.
Maybe there's some analog to a Fresnel lens effect or something between near and far field. I don't know. Or incoherence to coherence or something like that. But all righty. Well, very cool. So yeah, this I'm gonna have to soak in a little more about this because it's weird to think of, and then I'm wondering what the resistor does in the circuit. If you have a resistor contained within a conductor, it's gonna for a given voltage, it's gonna give you less current and less power at the load end. So how does that manifest in a field? It weakens the field. And why does it weaken the field? It's inhibiting, I guess, electron flow. So I guess the flow is the genesis of the field. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's sort of chicken and the egg. Without an electron flow, you're not going to get the initial induced magnetic field, which will produce an induced electric field, and so on and so on. And with alternating currents, surprisingly, the direction of the electromagnetic field doesn't reverse when the direction of the electrons bouncing back and forth in an alternating current. They persist in the same direction, which can confuse a lot of us. So there's that. If you take a look at some of the links that I provided this week, people try different ways of explaining it in more classical terms that are not quite accurate. They reduce the loop of wire to antennas. So one is transmitting the signal, one is receiving the signal at the speed of light. Others use it as two separate lines that have a capacitive coupling. Others take it as two separate lines that have an inductive transformer-like situation. A little bit more finesse are the people who treat it as a lumped circuit of a series of inductors in series and capacitors in parallel. That's basically transmission line theory. That makes an interesting observation of how the transient signals work. There's a big difference between a transient signal and a steady state signal. So most of these cases apply to the transient. the temporary portion of time before everything equilibrates. So there's a lot of confusion and a lot of attempt at making things simpler, which is fun, which is good, as long as you understand why they're doing it and what they're trying to do. The last example is the most interesting personally to me, where he went the opposite. This guy complicated things beyond belief. Very smart guy. Everything he said was true. But he threw in so many concepts that would give most people a migraine that it's amazing. It went on for an hour. So if you don't have problems with migraines and you're curious, you should really listen to the YouTube that says Explaining Veritasium, Electricity Video, Energy Doesn't Flow in Wires with Eric Bogatin. He's a professor of electrical engineering.
NY2H. All right, very good. Yeah, and the fact that field always goes from the source to the load is quite interesting. Also, and I think I saw that video, and he had, I don't know if he's using the right hand rule or I don't know if that was the pointer or some other designation. But yeah, that was also rather interesting. All right, I'll probably look at these more closely, these videos, and get more confused, get a migraine, and, you know, take an aspirin. But it's very interesting stuff, so that's it. Thank you very much. Back to that NY2H.
You're welcome, Lou. Yeah, I found it fascinating, and as soon as I realized that I could kind of use it as a kind of puzzle and as a deeper exercise in trying to understand and figure out what's going on, you know, the more I was really looking forward to discussing it last week, and I thought it went well. The problem with popularizing science is that inevitably you have to make a decision, which is difficult, of how much to simplify it. If you simplify it so that a five-year-old is comfortable with the subject, most likely your example is completely wrong and useless. But most people are satisfied with it. If you do what Dr. Bogatin did, and discuss the G factor of electrons and displacement currents and domain reflectometry and all kinds of stuff, you give a very close approximation to the real thing going on, but you confuse 99% of people. You know, the worst example that I've mentioned before on the technical net is Stephen Hawking, who was a brilliant physicist, brilliant. And one of the things that he's famous for is Hawking radiation, the temperature equivalent radiation that is emitted by a black hole's event horizon. Now, he gives an explanation in his very popular book that is complete nonsense. A physicist had yelled and screamed at the top of their lungs when they read that entry in the book. Some physicists were disappointed and thought that was all that Stephen Hawking had. If you went back to his original research papers, they were brilliant explanations that used special cases of quantum gravity, which is a really tough theory to even think about. And he did it correctly and he did it well, but I don't think he thought that the popular reading public would be able to take it, and so he made up a fairy story. And it's a sad thing. You know, I always get disappointed when people simplify stuff to the point of fairy tales. Anyone with any other comments about that subject from last week? I can assume that some of you were kind of burnt out by it, but others, if you have any insight, comments, questions, answers, revelations, please feel free. Okay, I'll let you guys ponder it. Maybe you'll reflect upon it next week. We'll see. Paul, WS2N, what question or comment for tonight do you have?
Okay, Roy, this is WS2N. I'm just wondering if anybody has a better idea for repairing steel wires that are copper clad that we use for sometimes dipoles. In my case, I have one that I use for G5RB Junior. I've had it a long time now, but I've had the problem where at one of the connections there's 4 points of failure. You know, you come up with coax, and then your coax connector connects to the little block, and then from there it goes out with ladder line. Those ladder line wires are made of steel wires that are copper clad, and then they lead up to the insulator. The insulator, of course, branches out to the dipole part of the G5RB, and that again is made of steel copper clad wire. So one goes left, one goes right. So that's two more points of failure. They have them like as wire comes up, it wraps around the one side, and the other one wraps around the other side. And it looks, you know, it looks the way that it's done. It looks like it's just mechanically on there. I don't see any solder or anything like that. But as time goes by, these things wiggle back and forth, wiggle back and forth. Yeah, let me drop it. And just like you could take a safety pin and it just bends back and forth, eventually it's going to break. And that's happened once to me at one location. I managed to repair that. And then this time it happened up near the dipole part. And the way I'll explain how I fix it, but I'm looking for a better way to do it. There must be some kind of mechanical gadget or something that they do. What I do is I take the ladder line, and, you know, it's broke, and I'll clean it up with a Dremel tool, you know, a little wire brush Dremel tool. Clean it up until it's a little shiny, you know, almost to the copper left on it, and then I wrap that. I clean up the joint that one part, half of the dipole that's going to connect to. Clean that up with the Dremel tool, and then I wrap it. I wrap it. You know, it kind of looks like what they do. They wrap it too. What I do, I solder it. I'll actually solder the, you know, from one to the other, and then what I do is to make it extra strong, I'll take 14-gauge wire. In my case, 14-gauge. You can take anything. Any of the stranded copper. Stranded is better than solid in this case. And I wrap that around just, maybe one and a half times. And then I solder that to what I had just soldered. And then I call it a day. I'm not sure if it's going to last. I've done this before. It has lasted. But I wonder if there's a better way. Well, let me drop it. I've heard people on that have G5RBs, and that's happened too, and they either with it and go with a completely different system, or they'll go out and buy another G5RB because they might have liked that antenna. I just repair it, but I wonder if you have a better idea for repairing this, or whatever I'm doing is good enough. Back to you, Roy. AC2GS WS2N.
Okay, very good. That's an interesting question. I own a couple of rolls of copper-clad steel wires. They're a bit of a pain in the backside to deal with because they have that kind of built-in coiling that that they come off the manufacturer, and they really, really have a long history with it that they don't forget. And so it's very difficult to move it around and to adjust it. It lacks the ductility of pure copper wires. And pure copper wires, it's not a big problem. You see the old AT&T splice diagrams of how you loop together the two broken pieces of copper wire. You coil them to the base, and then you solder them, and that should hold. But I think having played with copper-clad steel, they don't play well, which is probably why you got into the habit, which is a good move, of placing an extra layer of pure copper around it as a shield and adding that to keep everything together. Because otherwise, I would think the steel would kind of unwind after a while, even with the soldering. So I think your idea is good. There probably are crimping tools available that have a decent ability to just physically clamp on with friction and hold the copper-clad steel wires. I can't tell you of any brand off the top of my head. But I'd be curious if people out there have come across copper-clad steel wires and discovered the optimum way of splicing them together.
K2CJE, Ed.
Yes, Ed.
The outside of the copper clad is copper, and they make these little connectors for electrical work, which are called bug nuts. They're copper, and they're like a U and a nut. And rather than going to all the trouble of soldering and wrapping each time, and it's going to break from the flexing, just take the two wires, run one or two bug nuts around it, tighten the nuts, and in two minutes, it's all done and finished. And down the line, it's going to break again, over.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George?
What is the composition of the nut?
Copper.
Copper and steel again. So you've got the dielectric, it's not constant.
Ed, that's not a problem. It's the flexing from the wind, over.
I'm finding the difference is the metal itself, the different metals not being able to withstand the electrical currents. We can mechanically build it as well as we want, but if we use dissimilar metals, that's the first constant that we have to overcome.
WS2N. Before I forget, if I find out from Ed, what kind of nut is he saying? Something nut. I'm missing the word.
It's bug nuts. B-U-G space N-U-T-S. I pulled up, because as I always say, Google is your friend. I pulled up a page from a company called Kraftwerk Tools that shows a galvanized version of it, but I'm sure it comes in other metal varieties. They describe it as a lashing wire clamp.
Okay, I'm going to try that. That's a good idea. I'll try anything. That's very good. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Ed. Thank you. I was thinking of some kind of a crimping, but you know, screwing things together might be better than a crimp. Interesting material. You know, if anyone has an opportunity to play around with it at some point or other and hasn't yet, you might want to, because it has unique physical qualities. It's very good as far as mechanical stress. Because the core itself is steel instead of copper, you don't have the ductility. It won't kind of stretch and loosen up, and it takes a little bit more oomph to snap it. And since it is clad in copper and the skin effect, as we all know and love, it doesn't really impact upon the transmission of energy through it.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
Thank you, Roy. This is George, and the fact that galvanized iron-based metals, even steel, whatever, iron-based metals to adhere to copper or aluminum-based. Galvanized does not work with it at all. That's my experience. You will find that you're eating holes into the softer metals.
Okay, but in this case, although it's copper clad, it's a steel base, so it's just the outer layer is soft. And I was just mentioning that this particular example was galvanized. I'm sure they use other metals. Of course, everyone out there knows galvanized means that it's dipped in or in some way covered with a thin layer of zinc.
Roy, my experience is no dissimilar metal at all for good RF. RF communication, I mean, if you want your RF signals to really go through metal connections, there are no dissimilar metals at all. You might be able to use a complex tinning, which AKA is a very good soldering, but no dissimilar metals should be connected. KD2FIU.
Okay, George, but I'm saying that the wire clamps probably also come in either brass or copper. So there's a way around that and still using a similar tension device to secure broken copper-clad steel wires. I think it's a reasonable thing to give a try, and if people do and they like it or don't like it, they can always come back and tell us if it passed or failed.
Yeah, and this is Paul WSON. I heard Ed say that they make these bug nuts in copper, so that wouldn't be a problem. My other dipole is an 80 meter dipole. Yeah, a regular 14 stranded gauge copper. Of course, I don't have that problem with that. You know, I might have it insulated that bolt comes off the, you know, off the tree from a rope or something, but I don't have the this breakage problem that the copper clad wire has. And as far as dissimilar metals, I mean the copper clad wires, I mean the name itself is a dissimilar metal. They use in copper and steel. Back to you, Roy.
Well, yeah, but also you have to understand that this is a totally encased different metals. The problem with galvanic response with dissimilar metals is when you stick two of them together on in the environment, and eventually you get a little salt water on it, and it becomes its own little battery and becomes a source of dissimilar metal galvanic corrosion. If you totally shield one of those metals up, there's no real opportunity for any galvanic responses, and you know that's the case with the copper clad. There's a lot of conductors of coax cables that are dissimilar metals with a copper cladding covering it up. There's aluminum with copper cladding. There's all kinds of interesting bimetallic conductors that we use on a lot of coaxial cables. So, you know, when people talk about the galvanic response of dissimilar metals, they're usually talking about things that are kind of open. The interface of the two metals is open to the environment.
KD2FIU.
Yes, Ed first, then George.
K2GJE, Ed. Paul, go to an electrical supply house. These bug nuts come in all different sizes. You might just ask the one to join two 14-gauge wires. That probably would be the adequate size, over.
I heard you, Ed. That's good. Yeah, I have an electrical supply see me. No problem. We can do it. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I'm looking at another page from something that calls itself Master Elevator Components. They show nice big copper bug nuts. Basically, they're kind of hollow screws, and they're slotted, and there's a nut that goes over it. And so as you tighten the nut, the two legs of the split nut go closer and closer and clamp on to the wires that you put through the middle. It's an interesting design.
KE2FIU?
Yes, George, please.
Yes, when you're dealing with copper clad over steel, you're dealing with the steel for the strength of the thinner gauge wire. Copper is your conductor, so the interaction between them is not really the conductor. The copper on the outside of it is. They are not reacting for your conductivity. The outside of the conductor is. So the steel is the strength inside. It's not like you're making a connection between them or a physical connection that you want to make for your conductor or antenna system. The caution is with steel, copper clad, is that you don't strip too much copper off when you're making your connections. You can up to a certain level, but steel is not your connector. Still, the outer shield of your copper on the steel is. Steel is the stronger run of wire at that point.
My goodness.
So what I'm trying to say here is that it's not a matter of the metal being conductively compatible. It's a matter of the steel being strength and the outer run of copper being your conductor. KD2FIU.
Okay, the dissimilar metal situation is not really due to differences in the resistance of each conductor. It has to do with a concept called electronegativity, the tendency of one metal to give up an electron with less force than another one. And so if you have two dissimilar metals with dissimilar electronegativities, you can have a situation where the electrons from one is going to the other one, and that's, you know, why we call it a galvanic battery response type of thing. And that tends to add to corrosion. So that the phenomena of galvanic corrosion of dissimilar metals is not a conductivity situation, but an electronegativity characteristic of different conductors. If you were to find two conductors that might have completely different conductance, but they have the same exact electronegativity, there would not be any kind of galvanic dissimilar metal corrosion that takes place in that type of a situation.
But I wasn't speaking of a galvanic corrosion. What I was speaking about is what is the conductor and what is not.
Well, yes. I mean, earlier on I mentioned that thankfully we have the skin effect of RF. And the skin effect of RF transmissions means that the flow of electrons is occurring at the micron level of the surface of the conductor, not in its core where the steel is.
Precisely, but that doesn't bring us back to connecting it. That's the issue that we were really addressing with the question in the beginning here. How do we connect dissimilar metals? There's a lot of ways, and somebody asked that question. I'm sorry, I forgot who it was, but the problem is, how do you connect them so that over time, even a short period of time, with different oxygen and water capabilities to erode this. I mean, it could happen over a couple of weeks. It could happen over a couple of months. If you have dissimilar metals, you don't have a good connection.
Okay, I agree with you, and I don't think anyone actually brought up that topic. I might have introduced it accidentally, just mentioning that I was looking for bug nuts, and the first one that I came across were galvanized bug nuts. But I wasn't suggesting that Paul should use the galvanized bug nuts. I just said that, you know, they do exist. I do see them. Now I looked a little farther, and they're nice and coppery. So, yes, you should try and not use dissimilar metals when making some circuit that's connected to each other, because you're just introducing more problems to your situation. So we agree, George.
Roy, can I make one more statement?
Please, feel free.
Galvanized gets connected to galvanized. That's it. We do not connect it for RF. We don't connect it to steel, copper, or aluminum.
Okay. Once again, no one suggested that we do. I, again, just mentioned that the object that I came up first on my Google search was a galvanized version of that technology. That's all.
Thank you. Based on experience and watching it corrode. Thank you.
And WS2N, one more comment.
Yes, certainly, Paul.
Yeah, interesting how I found it this time. You know, working 40 meters, CW. And I hit the antenna tuner button on the Kenwood 440. No problem, the thing's tuning up. But I was transmitting and not getting people that I should normally think I could get. You know, some people I was getting, but not that many. So that means it was only going out on that one leg. And it wasn't until I went out, like, maybe about a week or two later. And I'm looking close. I said, what is this? Something wrong with my antenna. And sure enough, I could just see that it was separated at that one location. So I lowered it down, you know, and that's how I got involved with that. But what was interesting was, even though it was disconnected on that one side, my antenna tuner was actually tuning up that wire, even though it was only, you know, one wire was completely disconnected. I thought that was strange. I just wish if it wasn't tuning up at all, it would have been easy. I could have said, oh, okay, something's wrong somewhere, my radio, the coax, the antenna, something. But, it gave me a false sense of that it was working, but it wasn't. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, Paul, I mean, that's one of the big problems of having a really nice antenna tuner. I make the joke that my Palomar can probably tune a doorknob. I'm sure almost everyone has had the experience where their antenna was mostly disconnected. I had a fan dipole. I'm a big fan of fan dipoles. And at one point, the center mast kind of bounced all over the place, and a lot of the fan dipole elements snapped off. So there were a lot of fan dipoles that were monopoles. Yet, I was able to actually tune them to a 50-ohm impedance. They were awful antennas, but they were 50-ohm impedance thanks to my Palomar antenna tuner / impedance transformer. So just because our antennas are nominally 50 ohms of impedance do not really mean that they're resonant and functioning. They could be incredibly inefficient and meaningless. It could be a dummy load for all we know. So unfortunately, we all kind of rely on our standing wave ratios and impedance measurements and such, and you can't do that 100%. So that's a lesson that you demonstrate.
KZ2FIU.
Yes, George.
Roy, can I finish on the last subject real quick?
Sure, I thought you had, but please feel free.
Hot tinning with complex soldering is your best connection for dissimilar metal, and it cannot be galvanized metal. You can bring steel, iron, and copper together, and in some cases, aluminum, dense aluminum. Bring it together with solders of high complex tinning capability containing lead and silver. If you bring it together with a small amount of heat, you will have some durability. And that's all. That was my best experience, Roy, KD2FIU.
AC2GS, well, thank you very much. George, I just have one question. What specifically is dense aluminum? I assume it's an alloy that contains aluminum, because aluminum has only one density that I'm aware of.
I'm sorry, Roy. It has to do with the density of the conductor itself, not the chemical composition of aluminum, the density of the conductor with the surrounding other chemicals being of less density.
Okay, I'm still not quite sure if the term would be dense aluminum, though. There's probably another term for it, I guess.
Diameter of composition.
Well, that still gives you the same density. Density is not a function of mass. It's weight over volume. So if you increase the diameter, you increase the volume and you increase the mass, and you keep the density the same.
Negative. What happens is that when you're heating it, the amount of oxygen will also be different from the amount of what helium has to do in the air, and it is a matter of the size, the density of the aluminum. You can solder to it if you have a certain diameter of it. So what you have is a helium versus oxygen composition going on. So you'll see it in a glow, a certain glow going on. It's an arcing that occurs.
Okay, not quite sure where helium came in. I'm assuming you're discussing some kind of inert gas welding technology.
And it can occur with soldering at regular normal air density.
Well, again, I'm having problems with air density. That sounds like air pressure to me, and that's a phenomena of weather and what kind of elevation you have. But there's a negligible amount of helium in atmospheric gases, really, 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 really low, negligible. So I'm not quite sure. I could understand, like argon, if you're using some inert gas in a weld, but you can't really rely on the amount of helium in the atmosphere, because unless you're in an NMR room where it's venting from a superconductor, chances are there's next to nothing of helium in the air.
Have you ever done welding?
Well, that's what I'm talking about. If you're talking about inert gas welding, you're getting the helium from a tank that says helium, which is fine. If you're not, then I don't quite know where the helium is coming from, again, because although there's a little bit of argon in atmospheric air, there's almost no helium.
It breaks down as you're heating it. Oxygen breaks down. There's a big difference on what you have. You ever done welding?
No, I haven't. I haven't done a lot of different things, but I have a strong suspicion that helium, unless you introduce it by a tank, is not really part of the process. If anyone out there has expertise in non-inert gas wheeling, then please share with us.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, okay. I spent my life welding, there's different types of welding. Naturally, the arc welding, and they use the flux when that's burning, and that does away with all the oxygen in the area. Then they have, for finer work, and better work, you have the heliarc, or also known as TIG, tungsten inert gas welding. And that inert gas, the I part, is usually done with argon, or in factories where there's a tremendous amount of that type of welding done in the factory, they'll use carbon dioxide. I've used that. The carbon dioxide, too. They actually have manifolds coming off the wall in a big factory. They use so much of it, and they'll use the carbon dioxide. They'll tap into that and use that into your welding system. And then there's MIG, the metal inert gas welding. That's the motorized ones where you've got this reel and you put a reel of wire and you put it on your machine, and that's motorized, and it forces the wire through the cable, and as you push it, that wire becomes the feed for the welding, and on and on. But helium is not part of it. Back to you, Rick.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I think you could probably use it. It's probably not cost effective. Argon is a perfect type of inert gas for that technology because it's a waste product when people concentrate either nitrogen or oxygen. They take it usually out of the air, and most of the air is nitrogen, 20-odd% is oxygen, and 1 or 2% is argon. So you can reclaim the argon and put it in tanks and sell it to people to use for inert gas welding. So that's, all these things are of interest to me. I'm not quite sure where helium sort of fits into this particular picture. That's all.
And they all have a different amount of oxygen input.
Okay, well, you're talking about welding, and the flammable fuel versus oxygen mixing ratios are different for different combustibles. So, yeah, they have different amounts of oxygen.
Right.
Yes, Paul.
The three types of welding I was talking about, which arc welding, MIG, and TIG, the idea is to eliminate oxygen 100%. Those gases for either argon or carbon dioxide, they're coming through the thing, the part that you're holding, the torch that they call, and then that gas is covering the spot that you're welding. The idea is to eliminate any oxygen that's in the atmosphere. So, I mean, if you hold that at the wrong angle, you'll start to bring in air. It'll suck in air, and then you wind up with a bad joint. So you have to hold it just at the right angle. The idea is to do away with it. And of course, with regular arc welding, the flux around the steel rod is burning off, and as that's burning, of course, that's burning, and it's
burning any oxygen around in that area, and that's why you wind up with a pure weld. If you get any kind of oxygen into the joint, you're going to wind up with porosity, and it's going to be a failed welded joint, right?
Yeah, well, most of those technologies will use an electric current to produce the high temperatures. They, you know, spot welding with gas, you know, flammable gas and such, people kind of do little dibs and dabs or plumbing jobs with stuff like that. But heavy-duty, high-quality welding joints are not usually used, as far as I'm aware, with chemical flammables. They're electric current heating things up, and then you modify the environment by shrouding it in something like argon.
Yeah, right, of course. The idea is to eliminate oxygen. They have submerged arc welding, nothing to do with anything being submerged, but the joint itself is being submerged with the flux. They pour flux into a hopper, and a hopper, you know, is directed toward the puddle that's being welded, and then that's usually a mechanized system, and that you really wind up with a very pure weld with that on large, very thick metals, no problem. But you know, that's a whole different world. But I'm looking for something for a little wire. You know, I mean, I could try brazing it or something like that, but that just weakens the little wire. That it, you know, I know you're going off into another world with welding, and you're talking about the different steels, the Schedule 40s, the Schedule 80 steels. You can go on and on, but I just want to thank you for coming up with the answer, and Ed coming up with that answer about the copper. Bug nuts. I'm going to look into that. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, you're welcome, Paul. You know, that's the nature of the technical net. We kind of meander like a river, and we ebb and flow into all kinds of interesting subjects. You know, welding is a fascinating subject. I've seen a lot of YouTubes on it. I've never done it myself personally. It came up in many discussions of Elon Musk's ideas of these vacuum loops, these transport devices where he wants to maintain a near perfect vacuum over hundreds of miles. And you could imagine the weld joints you have to manifest in order to maintain vacuums like that. I don't think there's technology capable of doing it over long distances. I think even the JPL would have a problem engineering something like that.
KD2FIU?
Yes, George.
Hi, Paul. A soldering tin with at least 5% silver should get you through a good, reasonable endurance of the connectivity between the dissimilar metals. Never bring in galvanized.
Okay, on that point, let's move on to something new. Does anyone out there have any questions? It could be amateur radio technology, preferably. If not, we can do other aspects of science. We can do medicine. Again, I do not diagnose, treat over radios, so just general discussions. And if anyone wants to bring up the dreaded Omicron variant, we can discuss that as well. So I leave it open to you guys and gals. If you're interested and you have a question or a topic or a comment, give me your first name and your call sign.
Hey, it's K2GJE. Tell us about this variant before I go to sleep, over.
Okay. Once upon a time, unfortunately, in South Africa, they discovered a new variation on the COVID-19 virus. there have been loads of mutations on this virus. Viruses that are effectively infecting a lot of people have a great opportunity to mutate and get their instructions wrong, terribly wrong, and the virus is basically non-functional. Occasionally, the modifications have no effect and still go on. Other times, they have a slightly more beneficial effect for the virus, and they amplify the infectivity of the virus. This has happened before. The Delta variant has been found to be something, well, significant.